Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And in this week's Pan-African Journal, we're going to begin, of course, with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports, so stay tuned for this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. Welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe, and we're broadcasting live this week from our studios in the city of Detroit. We're right today on the eve of the annually federally recognized commemoration of the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the human rights and civil rights and peace martyr and activist who was slain in Memphis, Tennessee in 1968 on April the 4th, to be exact, in 1968. His birthday is commemorated every year, and of course here in the city of Detroit, we are very fortunate to have a Detroit Martin Luther King Planning Committee, which in fact puts together an annual rally, march, community dinner, and cultural program honoring and reclaiming the peace and social justice legacy of the martyred Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We'll have more information on Detroit MLK Day in the upcoming minutes and hours of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. Of course, we are here at the Pan-African Journal, and we're honored to have you as our listeners. We, of course, are being broadcast through the Pan-African Radio Network. Coming up on the Pan-African Journal, we will have, of course, our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. And, of course, this week, the focus of much of the discussion on the Pan-African Newswire, of course, will be the ongoing war, imperialist war, led by France and NATO against the West African state of Mali and the spreading of this war to the North African state of Algeria. So stay tuned for this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. Thank you. Greetings once again. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And, of course, this week, the Pan-African Journal will feature our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. And in the Pan-African Newswire this week, a lot of discussion is going to be held on the ongoing military and political situation in the West African state of Mali, as well as the North African state of the North African state of Algeria. And of course, there is a full-blown war that has been initiated by French imperialism, backed up by the United States, Britain, Denmark, Norway, and other NATO countries. There's a meeting that is taking place today in the Cote d'Ivoire capital of Abidjan that is attended by the West African leadership. We're going to be dealing with all these issues in this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. So stay tuned, and we'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe, and we're broadcasting today, January 19th, 2013, live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. And we were just listening to the sound of Shala Mwana from the Democratic Republic of Congo with the tune entitled Imoni. And, of course, here on the eve of the annually commemorated Dr. Martin Luther King Day, it is a federally recognized holiday inside the United States, and we'll have more information on that, as well as some recorded messages from the late, great, martyred Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. He, of course, is one of the great leaders of the 20th century, and, of course, his legacy is very much a part of what we are experiencing today in the United States and around the world. Dr. King fought for peace. He was against war. He was against poverty. And, of course, we have renewed war in Africa and other parts of the world. Consequently, the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. informs our activism and our overall outlook today in 2013. And we're going to take another musical break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Tumba.
Abayomi Ezekwe. Welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. We're here on January the 19th, 2013, broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. Another tune there from Shala Muana from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And, of course, this weekend we're honoring the federally recognized holiday in tribute to the martyred late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who would have been 84 years old just this last past January the 15th, had he been alive. And, of course, every year in the city of Detroit, there is the annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Rally and march that takes place at Central United Methodist Church located in downtown Detroit, a venue where Dr. King spoke during his life. He spoke there, in fact, just a few weeks prior to his untimely death via assassination. Dr. King, of course, being recognized as one of the key leaders of the civil rights and peace movements of the 1950s and 1960s. And we'll be right back with this week's segment of the Pan-African Newswire on the Pan-African Journal.
Oh, mwana bande kokangela ngai elongi utanga na yo toka mwana bandeko na sala ya ngai nganda ya koteka masanga nakoma libre nakoma libre nakoma libre
Back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And coming up, we're going to start Pan-African Newswire reports. The Pan-African Newswire is an electronic press agency that is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week medium providing alternative and very much needed information on the affairs of African people on the continent as well as around the world. In the background, we're listening to the sound of Franco and the TPOK Jazz Orchestra with the tune entitled Liberté, recorded in 1975. And, of course, it's always an honor and a pleasure to be with you here on the Pan-African Journal, broadcast over the Pan-African Radio Network based here in the city of Detroit. And this week, of course, we're honoring the 84th birthday of the martyred Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who just this last past January the 15th, on Tuesday, would have been 84 years old. King's message and legacy of peace and social justice is very much a part of what informs us today in 2013, in the 21st century, in the so-called contemporary period. And, of course, we will have more information on the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King later on in this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and we're going to start in just a couple of minutes with this week's edition or segment of the Pan-African Newswire as part of the Pan-African Journal. There's a lot to discuss this week in light of the ongoing war being faced in the West African state of Mali and, of course, in the North African state of Algeria. And we have been covering these developments over the Pan-African Newswire as well as the Pan-African Journal. So please stay tuned to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe, and right now we're going to begin with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. And we'd just like to mention that the Pan-African Journal for today, January 19th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. As we mentioned before, we need to reemphasize that we're on the eve of the annual commemoration of the federally recognized holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Our focus on the Pan-African Newswire will, of course, be centered on the French-NATO war on the West African state of Mali and its spillover into the neighboring North African state of Algeria. And in beginning this week's segment of the Pan-African Journal, Pan-African Newswire, we're going to be covering the following stories. The Algerian government has announced that the crisis involving the seizure of the En Amenas gas field and the hostages which have been taken has ended. Reports are surfacing indicating that over 40 people have died, with many others being unaccounted for by the authorities in Algiers. West African state leaders are meeting in the capital of Ivory Coast at Abidjan to discuss the war in Mali. Ivory Coast, of course, was the center of another French and U.S. war in 2011 that overthrew the leader of that country, Laurent Gbagbo, who is now being held prisoner in the Netherlands. The African Union is beginning its 20th summit in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, starting tomorrow, January the 20th. This year represents the 50th anniversary of the formation of the Organization of African Unity, formed also in Ethiopia on May 25th of 1963. And finally, Monday, January the 21st, will represent the federally recognized holiday in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. King would have been 84 years old just this last past January the 15th. Now, the Algerian Special Forces stormed a natural gas complex in the middle of the Sahara Desert today, January the 19th, 2013, in what is being described as, quote, a final assault, unquote, that ended a four-day-old hostage crisis, according to the state news agency and two foreign governments. At least 19 hostages and 29 Islamists have been killed in the operations. The report, quoting a security source, didn't say whether any hostages or Islamists remained alive, and it didn't give the nationalities of those who have been confirmed dead. It said the army was forced to intervene after a fire broke out in the plant and said that the captors killed the hostages. It wasn't immediately possible to verify who killed the captives. Seven hostages and 11 militants from the Islamist organization were killed in the operation today on January the 19th, adding to the previous tally of 12 captives and 18 kidnappers being killed. The An Aminas plant is jointly run by BP, Norway's state oil, and Algeria's state-owned oil company. The governments of Norway and Britain said they received confirmation that the siege was over. Nonetheless, just 2 days ago, it was reported widely through the international press that the seizure was also over as well when the first attempt by the Algerian Special Forces was carried out to end the standoff. Now, the entire refinery was mined with explosives and set to blow up, the Algerian state oil company Sonarash said in a statement, adding that the process of clearing the explosives had begun. The Algerian media reported that militants had planned to blow up the complex. The siege transfixed the world after radical Islamists linked to the Al-Qaeda network stormed the complex, which contained hundreds of plant workers from all over the world. Now, there's been contradictory reports in regard to this organization and its links to the so-called Al-Qaeda network. Some reports have indicated that the organization is independent of Al-Qaeda. Others have said that it was previously associated with the Al-Qaeda network. Algeria's response to the crisis was typical of the country's history in confronting the similar operations by various organizations. They stress military action over negotiation. And, of course, it has caused an international outcry from countries worried about their nationals being held at the An Aminas gas field. Algerian military forces twice assaulted the areas where the hostages were being taken and held with minimum apparent negotiation, first on Thursday, as we mentioned earlier, and then today. The latest deaths bring the official Algerian tally of dead to 19 hostages and 29 so-called militants, although reports on the number of dead, injured, and freed have been contradictory throughout the entire standoff. Now, the Islamists originally said they had seized 41 foreign hostages. The organization attacked the plant on Wednesday morning. They crept across the border with Libya, approximately 60 miles or 100 kilometers away, and fell on a pair of buses taking foreign workers to the airport. The buses' military escort drove off the attackers in a blaze of gunfire that sent bullets zinging over the heads of crouching workers. A Briton and an Algerian, probably a security guard, were killed in the initial clashes. Frustrated, the militants turned to the vast gas complex, divided between the workers' living quarters and the refinery itself, and seized hostages. The Algerian government said the gas flow to the site was cut off. On Thursday, Algerian helicopters opened fire on a convoy carrying both kidnappers and their hostages, resulting in many deaths, according to witnesses. Now, this is an unfolding military situation that is taking place in the North African state of Algeria. In their final communication, the Islamic organization said they were holding seven hostages, three of whom were from Belgium, two were from the United States, one was Japanese, and another one was from Britain. They had threatened to kill them if the Algerian army had attacked the gas field. Algerian authorities estimated that about 50 captors occupied the An Aminas site Wednesday, and with 18 already reported dead, it appeared today, January the 19th, that the hostage crisis was finally over. The standoff has put the spotlight on the Islamic organizations. They are active in the Sahara Desert area. According to international reports, they have made numerous threats against the vital infrastructure and energy interests controlled and owned by the Algerian government in partnership with various foreign corporations from Europe. The Islamists initially said their operation was intended to stop a French attack on Islamists in neighboring Mali, although they later said it was 2 months in the planning, long before the French intervention. The accounts of hostages who escaped the complex highlight the cavalier attitude towards their lives taken by both the captors as well as the Algerian military. Ruben Andrada, who is 49 years old and a Filipino civil engineer who works as one of the project management staff for the Japanese company, the JGC Corporation, described how Algerian helicopter gunships had earlier opened fire on vehicles carrying hostages and the gunmen who used them as shields. Just 2 days ago, about 35 hostages, guarded by 15 Islamists, were loaded into seven SUVs in a convoy to move them from the housing complex to the refinery. Andrada said in his interview with the international press, the Islamists placed, quote, an explosive cord, unquote, around their necks and were told it would detonate if they tried to escape. Quote, when we left the compound, there was shooting all around, unquote, said Andrada. He was describing the helicopter attack. He then said, quote, I closed my eyes. We were going around in the desert. To me, I left it all to fate, unquote. Andrada said when the vehicle he was in overturned, some of the passengers were able to escape. He sustained cuts and bruises and was grazed by a bullet on his right elbow. He later saw the blasted remains of other vehicles and the severed leg of one of the gunmen. The site of the gas plant spread out over several acres and includes a housing complex and the processing site about a mile apart, making it especially complicated for the Algerians to secure the site and, of course, likely contributed to the lengthy standoff. Quote, it is a big and complex site. It's a huge place with a lot of people there and a lot of hiding places for hostages and terrorists, unquote, said Colonel Richard Kemp, a retired commander of British forces who had dealt with hostages rescue missions in Iraq as well as Afghanistan. Quote, these are experienced terrorists holding the hostages, unquote. Now, casualty figures varied widely. The Algerian government now says 19 hostages and 29 Islamists have died since Thursday, January the 17th. Before the final assault, the militants claim through the Mauritanian website ANI that the helicopter attack alone killed 35 hostages and 15 Islamists. One American from Texas is among the dead, and the militants offered to trade two other American hostages for two prisoners being held behind bars in the United States, an offer which was firmly rejected by the United States State Department. At least one Briton, a Frenchman, and Algerians have also died in the standoff. Escaped Algerian workers described seeing people of many nationalities, including Japanese, dead and wounded. French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said on January 19th today that there are believed to be no more French hostages in the gas complex. He said the Frenchman killed, Yann Desjus, was a former member of the French Special Forces and part of the security team. The remaining three French nationals who were at the plant are now free, the foreign ministry said. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague confirmed that as of Saturday, there were, quote, fewer than 10, unquote, British nationals still at risk or unaccounted for, and the majority of, unquote, Britons at the plant were now safe, he said. Stadol Chief Executive Officer Helge Lund said today that there were only six Norwegians unaccounted for from the 17 at the plant at the time of the attack. Romanian Prime Minister Victor Ponta said today one Romanian hostage was killed in the course of the siege, while four escaped unharmed. The attack by the Mali-based MASS brigade had been in the works for 2 months, a member of the brigade told the online Mauritanian news outlet. He said that the militants targeted Algeria because they expected the country to support the international effort to root out the Islamists in neighboring Mali, and it was carried out by a special commando unit, quote, those who signed in blood, unquote, tasked with attacking nations supporting the intervention in Mali. The kidnappers focused on the foreign workers, largely leaving alone the hundreds of Algerian workers who were briefly held hostage before being released or escaping. Several of them arrived haggard-looking, on a late night flight into Algiers yesterday, January the 18th, and described how the Islamists stormed the living quarters and immediately separated out the foreigners. Muhammad, a 37-year-old nurse who, like the others, wouldn't allow his last name to be used for fear of trouble for himself or his family, said at least five people were shot to death, their bodies still in front of the infirmary when he left on Thursday night. Shaban, who worked in food services, said he bolted out the window and was hiding when he heard the militants speaking among themselves with Libyan, Egyptian, and Tunisian accents. At one point, he said, they caught a Briton. Quote, they threatened him until he called out in English to his friends, telling them, quote, come out, come out. They're not going to kill you. They're looking for the Americans, unquote, Shaban said. A few minutes later, they blew him away, unquote. And you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And, of course, we're reviewing developments in the North African state of Algeria, where a seizure of the N. Aminas gas field in the Sahara has supposedly been ended as a result of a special forces raid by the Algerian National Army. This, of course, is a result of the spillover of the war carried out by France over the last 8 days against the West African nation of Mali under the guise of fighting Islamist terrorism. Now, additional information in regard to the current situation in Algeria. A final assault by Algerian special forces on the group of Islamist hostage takers who seized the N. Aminas gas facility has supposedly ended today with the deaths of at least seven remaining foreign hostages who reportedly included a person from the United Kingdom. Also killed was the Niger Islamist believed to have led the group, which Western media reports claim had been previously associated with the Al-Qaeda network. The leader of the unit carrying out the operation, it is said, is named Abdul Rahman al-Najiri. Britain's defense secretary, Philip Hammond, blamed the hostage takers for the, quote, appalling and unacceptable loss of life, unquote. If the death of another Briton is confirmed, it would be the third during the four-day crisis. Bob Dudley, chief executive of BP Corporation, one of the companies involved in operating the plant, said four of the country's staff were still missing and there were, quote, grave concerns, unquote, for their safety, while two employees have sustained wounds during the attack. 16 foreign nationals, including two Americans, two Germans, and a Portuguese national, were accounted for during today's operation. The 11 surviving Islamist fighters from the group of 40 who had attacked the plant in the Sahara just this last past Wednesday were all killed, according to the Algerian authorities, in the raid on a workshop where they had holed up. First reports suggested that the hostages were killed by their captors as the attempt to rescue them was launched. Official sources quoted by the Algerian newspaper El Watan said that the Islamists executed them after having given up hope of escape. The state oil and gas company, Sonatrach, said the hostage takers who identified themselves as those who signed in blood is a splinter group from the Al-Qaeda network of the Islamic Maghreb, the AQIM. They claim that the organization had booby-trapped a complex with explosives. Earlier today, Algerian special forces found 15 burned bodies at the gas plant. Now, details of the operation's bloody end emerged as it was revealed that the United Kingdom had offered assistance to the Algerian government, reportedly including British special forces. The offer was apparently rejected by the Algerian government. The hostage crisis began when two groups of the Islamists attacked two buses carrying the foreign workers and then took hundreds of Algerians and expatriates hostage at the complex. The group had been demanding the cessation of a French military operation against Islamists in northern Mali, as well as the release of two men jailed inside the United States. Just this last past Thursday, January the 17th, Algerian special forces mounted an operation to take back the plant to the initial dismay of the British and other governments, which were not notified apparently in advance. Now, according to the first accounts to emerge in the En Amenas plant, today's raid was launched after Nigeri and his group threatened to blow up the plant and kill the remaining hostages. The decision to go in was made after the attempts by the Islamists to sabotage and mine the plant were detected overnight on yesterday. According to Al Watan, the Algerian newspaper, the hostage takers had tried to sabotage the gas installation by starting a fire, but it was quickly extinguished. Quote, the terrorists, according to the Algerian newspaper, were prepared to commit a collective suicide. The army's intervention led to their neutralization. Unfortunately, the hostages were executed, unquote, the newspaper said. As the British ambassador to Algeria, Martin Roper, arrived with a consular team at En Amenas, a British foreign secretary, William Hague, said that while most of the 30 British nationals originally involved were known to be safe, the fate of, quote, fewer than 10, unquote, UK citizens remained unknown. Hague, who had cut short a trip to Australia to chair meetings of the government's emergency committee, COBRA, said, quote, we must continue to prepare ourselves for bad news, unquote. The crisis, he said, was a reminder of the, quote, scale and ruthlessness of the terrorist threat that we and other nations face, unquote. One senior government source said London had been hampered by a continuing lack of information from the Algerian government. David Cameron, who had to postpone a major speech on Europe yesterday to handle the crisis, was due to speak to the Algerian prime minister last night, and Hague was in touch with the Algerian foreign minister. And those are some of the updated reports in regard to the ongoing situation involving the seizure and the hostage taking of the situation that is going on right now in the Sahar in southern Algeria. The situation, of course, has claimed by the Algerian government and the corporate media has ended, but it's still not clear in regard to whether the situation has completely ended. And, of course, this is very important because it is a direct spillover in regard to the situation that is taking place in the West African state of Mali. And the West African leaders are meeting today in neighboring Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast. West African leaders are gathering for a summit on Mali to flesh out their plans for ramping up their military role alongside French imperialism, which is currently bombing and occupying the West African state of Mali. The meeting taking place today in Ivory Coast comes as the French-led military intervention in Mali enters its second week. Charles Kofi Dabi, Ivory Coast's foreign affairs minister, says Mali's neighbors must, quote, face up to the weight of our responsibilities in conducting and coordinating military operations in Mali, unquote. West African nations are expected to contribute about 3,000 troops, while France has said it has 1,800 forces in its former colony. France's unilateral move on January the 11th to intervene in Mali has put both European and African contributors to a long-planned UN-backed stabilization effort for Mali on a faster track. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Now, opposition to the ongoing French military action in the West African state of Mali has engendered increasing opposition throughout the region and also in other parts of the world. even though the French foreign ministers who met several days ago and pledged their support to the French military operations in Mali, other forces have come out strongly against the French imperialist intervention in Mali. Some of the organizations that have been involved and who have been vocal in opposition to the current situation in Mali have included the World Federation of Trade Unions, which is a socialist-oriented trade union federation with affiliates in many, many countries throughout the world. And we like to read excerpts from the World Federation of Trade Union statement that was put out on January the 15th in opposition to the French and imperialist intervention in the West African state of Mali. The World Federation of Trade Union statement says that the World Federation of Trade Unions strongly denounces the military intervention of the French, quote, socialist, unquote, government of François Hollande in Mali with the support of other imperialist forces, using as pretext the intensification of the conflicts between the Malian army and the militant organizations that are appearing to be fighting for the independence of northern Mali and Azawad. The statement by the World Federation of Trade Unions continues, saying that the military intervention was presented as a response to the request of the Malian president, Giacomo Traore, the president who was appointed in his position after the military coup of last March. This French-led military operation in its former colony has been a joint British, French, and European Union, as well as USA, Canada, and ECOWAS operation, all of whom have already been sending troops and air force to Mali and have been providing their support according to the December resolution of the United Nations Security Council. The World Federation of Trade Unions continues by noting that after the genocide in Rwanda and the demolition of the North African state of Libya, France continues to use the military bases it maintains in Africa in order to strengthen its role in the inter-imperialist competition and to serve the interests of its monopoly groups who are plundering the wealth-producing resources of gold, uranium, etc. This orchestrated conflict between the belligerents is another bloody show in the wounded African continent, with the African people paying a heavy toll aiming for the protection of the French interests in the uranium mines found in the Tuareg areas of the West African region. The inter-imperialist competition for the control of the wealth-producing resources of Mali and the placement of puppet governments in the African countries serving the leading imperialist forces. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And right now, you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. We're reading a statement issued by the World Federation of Trade Unions denouncing the imperialist intervention in Mali. The statement goes on to point out that the World Federation of Trade Unions, in solidarity with the working people and the poor people of Mali and the West African countries, is strongly denouncing the intensifying aggressiveness of the imperialist forces in the region that are further deteriorating the already difficult living conditions of the people in the region and are aiming for the maintaining and enhancing of the plundering of the wealth-producing resources which belong and should be used for the people's needs. Finally, we call upon the trade union federations, first and foremost, of the belligerent countries to denounce and act against the participation of their governments to this warfare. The position of each trade union on the issue of imperialist wars is crucial and constitutes a criterion of what type of trade union organization it is. The workers of the imperialist countries must express their international solidarity with their brothers and sisters in other countries. And that was a statement issued by the Secretariat of the World Federation of Trade Unions on January the 15th, denouncing the imperialist intervention in the West African state of Mali. Another organization which has entered the state issued a statement denouncing the French war on the West African state of Mali is the Workers' Party of Belgium. They issued a statement on January the 16th entitled "Workers' Party of Belgium Opposes Imperialist Intervention in Mali." The statement said that The Belgian government has decided to participate in the military intervention of France in Mali, contributing two C-130 transport planes, two helicopters, and 75 soldiers. The Western military force is avowedly aiming at stopping the advance of Islamist rebel groups in the north of the country at the demand of the Mali's government and with support provided only after the start of the intervention of the United Nations Security Council. With the military intervention of France, French President François Hollande plays a cavalier sous by his act of war. He undermines a peace initiative the UN elaborated with several African countries. The Workers' Party of Belgium statement goes on to say that the fact that Mali has recently become a hornet's nest is largely due to the consequences of the NATO war in Libya and the decades of Western political meddling in the country's affairs. In Mali's complex situation, the only chance for peace, stability, and development to succeed is by extremely cautious initiatives that have a large base of support and are principally African. France's intervention is, of course, not devoid of self-interest. As the former colonial power, France continues to have huge economic interests in the region. Mali possesses gold mines and petroleum, while also uranium is extracted in the region, which is used for part of the French nuclear industry. Just like with the deadly NATO bombing on Libya 2 years ago, Belgium has been very quick to offer its participation to the French military intervention. And this without any democratic debate about its objectives, consequences, or cost. In a period of painful austerity measures and cuts in the social budgets, any increase in the defense budget is simply cynical. The Workers' Party of Belgium statement concludes by saying that the Belgian government is not clear about the duration of its military intervention in Mali. Defense Minister Pieter de Kreem only informed the Belgian taxpayer that it could be of a, quote, very short run or medium, unquote, duration, as a first evaluation will be made only at the end of February. The mission will take at least 6 weeks. That is, as a starter, because this period may be prolonged several times yet, as was the case with the Belgian military mission in Afghanistan. In the meantime, for how many deeds, wounded and refugees in Mali, the Belgian government of Dia Rupo will be responsible. The last section of this statement by the Workers' Party of Belgium says the Workers' Party of Belgium, the PTB, is opposed to any imperialist intervention in Mali as elsewhere. So these are two organizations, anti-imperialist organizations, that have come out strongly in denouncing the French military intervention in the West African state of Mali. Those two organizations, the World Federation of Trade Unions and the Workers' Party of Belgium. Also, in Africa itself, there is growing opposition to the French military intervention. In Egypt, as well as Algeria, there have been demonstrations that have been taking place in opposition to the French intervention in Mali. Protesters in Egypt have held a rally in front of the French embassy in Cairo. This took place today. They chanted anti-French slogans and called on the Egyptian government to withdraw its ambassador from France. There was a woman president who was an Algerian national, who came to the demonstration in Cairo, calling upon Algeria to stop supporting the West in its aggression against the Muslim world. Also, the Egyptian president, Mohamed Morsi, voiced his opposition to the military intervention in Mali. Morsi said the situation must be dealt with wisely. Many people in Egypt have voiced their opposition to France's recent military intervention in Mali, just as they have also called for an end to the brutal aggression of the West against Muslims all over the globe. And the press inside of Algeria itself has been highly critical as well of the allowance or the intervention of France into the airspace of Algeria in order to carry out the massive bombing operation that's being protracted right now in the West African state of Mali. Now, the African Union is going to begin its 20th summit tomorrow, January the 21st. They are right now in the pre-summit proceedings on the margins of the 20th African Union Summit, which will be held under the overall theme of, quote, Pan-Africanism and African Renaissance, unquote. The 7th African Union pre-summit on gender opened on January the 17th at the African Union New Conference Center in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, with its own theme, quote, Women and Youth and Pan-Africanism and the African Renaissance, unquote. Now, organized by the African Union Commission Women and Gender Development Directorate in collaboration with the Department of Human Resources, Science and Technology, the two-day meeting is being held with special focus on the 10th theme of the African Women's Decade of Mentoring Youth, Women and Men, to be champions of gender equality. Its aims are to explore the implication of gender within the discourse of the African Renaissance and to make recommendations on how women can make meaningful contributions to creating an African Renaissance. Officially opening the meeting, Dr. Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma of the African Union Commission, she is the chairperson of the commission, said, and we quote, "It is our priority to strengthen our organization to respond better to the needs of our member states and our population," unquote. She emphasized that whatever framework we come up with is not only for the African Union Commission, but a framework for the African continent, unquote. Dr. Zuma stressed on the urgency to look forward for a better future for Africa. She said we have to concentrate on education, skill development, science and technology and innovation, among others. And the youth need to be the innovators, and hopefully the youth will change the image of Africa when they become active members in the society. The African Union Commission chairperson mentioned peace and security issues as a priority for Africa, which will disappear in the future. She said Africa needs to pay attention to development and balance peace and security with development on the continent. The African Union pre-summit on gender examined the important role that women and youth currently play and the potential role that could play for more effective integration of gender into Pan-Africanism and the African Renaissance across Africa. It also explores possible mechanisms for promoting women and youth as legitimate partners in Pan-Africanism and the African Renaissance. The meeting was attended by representatives of the WGDD, representatives of civil society organizations, representatives of youth, regional economic communities, researchers, academics, and development partners. The meeting will end and did end yesterday, January the 18th, and is a preparatory activity of the 20th African Union Summit, which is scheduled to start on Monday, January the 21st. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And finally, Monday, January the 21st, will represent inside the United States the federally recognized holiday in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. King would have been 84 years old just this last past Tuesday, January the 15th. All over the United States and all over the world, commemorations are being held in honor of the martyred civil rights leader who fought for the elimination of American apartheid as well as the succession of poverty and war as carried out by the United States. And here in the city of Detroit, where the Pan-African Journal is originating from, there will be the annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Rally in March to be held at Central United Methodist Church beginning on January the 21st, Monday at noon. Some of the features of the program will include a keynote address by Youth Minister Reverend C.D. Witherspoon, who is the president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in Baltimore. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference was formed by Dr. King and his colleagues in 1957. Other speakers include Attorney Jerome Goldberg and Vanessa Fluker, members of the Moratorium Now Coalition to Stop Foreclosures, Evictions, and Utility Shutoffs, Professor Charles Simmons of Eastern Michigan University, and Reverend Sandra Simmons of Hush House in Detroit. The program will be chaired by yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe. a member of the Detroit Martin Luther King Committee and actually a founder of Detroit's MLK annual rally in March in 2004. This represents the 10th annual Martin Luther King Day rally in March for the city of Detroit. The program is going to be held at Central United Methodist Church, the historic Central United Methodist Church, which, of course, is a place where Dr. King delivered his Lent speeches between 1958 and 1968. In fact, Dr. King delivered his annual Lent sermon just 3 weeks before he was assassinated at the historic Central United Methodist Church. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's edition of the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And concluding the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal for this week, we'd like to recap the main stories in the Pan-African Newswire for this week. The Algerian government has announced that the crisis involving the seizure of the N. Aminas gas field and hostage taking has ended. Reports are surfacing indicating that over 40 people have died, with many others being unaccounted for by the authorities in Algiers. The West African state leaders are meeting in the capital of Ivory Coast at Abidjan to discuss the war in Mali. Ivory Coast was the center of another French and U.S. war in 2011 that overthrew the leader of that country, President Laurent Gbagbo, who is now being held prisoner in The Hague in the Netherlands. The African Union Continental Organization is beginning its 20th summit in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, starting on January the 21st. This year represents the 50th anniversary of the formation of the Organization of African Unity, formed also in Ethiopia on May 25th of 1963. And finally, Monday, January the 21st, represents the federally recognized holiday in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. King would have been 84 years old just this last past Tuesday of January the 15th. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's segment of the Pan-African Newswire as part of the Pan-African Journal. We'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998, some decade and a half ago, and during the course of its existence has published thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, blogs, and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you want to read the Pan-African Newswire, all you have to do is log on to the following URL, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And, of course, you can log on to the Pan-African Newswire. And, of course, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an electronic press service that is brought to you on a weekly basis, and it is edited by yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe, who, in fact, is, of course, the host of the Pan-African Journal. We're going to take another brief musical break, and we'll be back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Oh,
Welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I'm your host, Abayomi Azikwe. We just heard the sound of Kaltoum, And, of course, Umm Kulthum is the voice of the Egyptian Revolution. And we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Thank you.
And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I'm your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today, January 19th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit on the eve of the annual commemoration of the federally recognized holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and we want to welcome back all of our listeners to the Pan-African Journal for this week. On Thursday evening, yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire and host of the Pan-African Journal, did an interview with Press TV on the current situation in Algeria and how from January the 17th. So stay tuned for more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal here on
Abayomi Ezekwe, who is the editor of the Pan-African Newswire, who is joining us now from Detroit, Michigan. Mr. Ezekwe, thanks a lot for joining us now. What exactly did happen as far as this hostage drama goes, and how does this all link in with Mali?
It's still not clear. All of the details are still coming out in regard to this horrendous event that occurred today, that began yesterday at the N. Aminas gas fields in southern Algeria. It appears as if the Algerian National Army engaged on a seizure operation that lasted for some 8 hours. Initial reports indicated that some 50 people had been killed in the operation. However, some have denied that the casualties were in that great number. However, we do believe that it's clearly related to the ongoing military operation, the bombings, the ground operations that is being carried out by France in neighboring Mali. There's been close links for generations between the peoples of Mali, particularly northern Mali and southern Algeria. In regard to the situation in Algeria, there has been, over the last two decades, insurgencies led by Islamist forces there. It appeared as if these difficulties and conflicts had been settled some 12 years ago with the negotiated settlement between various Islamist groups and the Algerian government. But with the current conflict going on right now in Mali, it could refuel these difficulties that the Algerian government has experienced over the last 2 decades.
Mr. Azikiwe, I wanted to, in fact, ask about Mali. Has France, in a sense, woken up a monster of sorts that it won't be able to control by intervening in Mali?
Well, all of the various groups that have been targeted in northern and central Mali have said that essentially they are widening the conflict inside Mali as well as throughout the entire region of West and North Africa. This is a operation that France has embarked upon, but we do believe that it's going to be a disastrous one. France does not have a strong track record in regard to intervention. We can look back at the situation that even in Algeria itself during the 1950s and early 1960s when they were fighting against the FLN who were demanding their national independence. Even before that in Vietnam, they suffered horrendous defeats at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. And even in Afghanistan recently, they withdrew all of their combat forces last year because of the high casualty rates that were being experienced by the French forces. We believe this is going to be no different in regard to the situation in Mali, and we believe that it's going to cause tremendous problems in regard to French-African relations and also relations between the overall European Union and various African states, and particularly grassroots organizations in Africa as well as in Europe. This operation by France has been denounced by the Workers' Party of Belgium, as well as the World Federation of Trade Unions. Anti-war organizations here in the United States have opposed as well the French intervention because it has drawn in the United States as well as Britain, Denmark, and other NATO countries. This is going to be a very, very long campaign and one that has many, many hidden and very disastrous dimensions.
All right, so we'll have to leave it for now. That was Mr. Abayomi Azikiwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, speaking to us live from Detroit. Sir, we do appreciate your insight here on Press TV.
And that was an interview in the World News segment for Press TV on Thursday, January the 17th, an interview that was carried out by yours truly, Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire and the host of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that is brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe, and we're honored and, in fact, very proud to have you back with us again this week. We'd like to mention that the Pan-African Journal is a byproduct of the Pan-African Radio Network. The Pan-African Radio Network was just formed earlier this month. It is based here in the city of Detroit, and we, of course, are very much honored to have all of you involved as listeners in this process of developing a Pan-African radio network that will provide this very vital information to all of our listeners throughout not only the United States, but throughout the entire world. So thank you so much for tuning in, and we are most honored to have you as part of this entire process. It's a very, very important process, and this, of course, is something that we need throughout the length and breadth of the African world. Today, January 19th, and we are here. And we are, of course, are going to continue to carry out this ongoing broadcast brought to you from the Pan-African Radio Network. And the Pan-African Radio Network, of course, is bringing you the Pan-African Journal. And hopefully we can enhance and expand these audio broadcasts here at the Pan-African Journal. We're going to take another musical break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Thank you.
And welcome back to the Pan-African Journal for this week. Today, January 19th, 2013, we're broadcasting live from our studios here in the city of Detroit. And this coming Monday, as we have been mentioning over the Pan-African Journal for this week, represents the internationally recognized holiday in commemoration of the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which in fact the exact date was on January the 15th of 1929. Dr. King, if he had been living, would have been 84 years old just this last past Tuesday. And we want to play some excerpts from a lecture delivered, a series of lectures delivered by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. entitled the Massey Lectures. They were delivered in November of 1967, some 6 months prior to the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Right now, let's listen to the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Massey Lectures for the CBC Nobel Peace Prize winner Dr. Martin Luther King talks about a subject that has forced him recently to widen his consideration of the possibilities of nonviolence beyond the civil rights work for which he is already famous. That subject is conscience and the war in Vietnam.
It is several months now since I found myself obliged by conscience to end my silence and to take a public stand against my country's war in Vietnam. The considerations which led me to that painful decision have not disappeared. Indeed, they have been magnified by the course of events since then. The war itself is intensified. Its impact on my country is even more destructive. I cannot speak about the great themes of violence and nonviolence, of social change and of hope for the future, without reflecting on the tremendous violence of Vietnam, not even when I am speaking to an audience of Canadians who are not directly involved in the war. Since the spring, when I first made public my opposition to my government's policy, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my decision. Why you, they have said. Peace and civil rights don't mix. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people? And when I hear such questions, I have been greatly saddened, for they mean that the inquirers have never really known me, my commitment or my calling. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live. In explaining my position, I have tried to make it clear that I remain perplexed, as I think everyone must be perplexed, by the complexities and ambiguities of Vietnam. I would not wish to underrate the need for a collective solution to this tragic war. Neither would I wish to present North Vietnam or the National Liberation Front as paragons of virtue, nor to overlook the role they can play in a successful resolution of the problem. While they both may have justifiable reasons to be suspicious of the good faith of the United States, life and history give eloquent testimony to the fact that conflicts are never resolved without trustful give and take on both sides. Since I am a preacher by calling, I suppose it is not surprising that I had several reasons for bringing Vietnam into the field of my moral vision. That is, at the outset, a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonical destructive suction tube. And so I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in southwest Georgia and east Harlem. And so we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village, but we realize that they would never live on the same block in Detroit. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness, but it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last 3 summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. For those who ask the question, aren't you a civil rights leader? And thereby mean to exclude me from the movement for peace, I answer by saying that I have worked too long and hard now to gain segregated public accommodations to end up segregating my moral concern. Justice is indivisible. It must also be said that it would be rather absurd to work passionately and unrelentingly for integrated schools and not be concerned about the survival of a world in which to be integrated. I must also say further that something in the very nature of our organizational structure in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference led me to this decision. In 1957, when a group of us formed that organization, we chose as our motto to save the soul of America. Now it should be incandescently clear that no one who has any concern for the integrity and life of America today can ignore the present war. As if the weight of such a commitment were not enough, another burden of responsibility was placed upon me in 1964. And I cannot forget that the Nobel Prize for Peace was also a commission to work harder than I had ever worked before for the brotherhood of man. This is a calling that takes me beyond national allegiances. But even if it were not present, I would yet have to live with the meaning of my commitment to the ministry of Jesus Christ. To me, the relationship of this ministry to the making of peace is so obvious that I sometimes marvel at those who ask me why I am speaking against the war. We are called to speak for the weak, for the voiceless, for victims of our nation, and for those it calls enemy. For no document from human hands can make these humans any less our brothers. And as I ponder the madness of Vietnam and search within myself for ways to understand and respond in compassion, My mind goes constantly to the people of that peninsula. I speak now not of the soldiers of each side, not of the hunter in Saigon, but simply of the people who have been living under the curse of war for almost three continuous decades now. I think of them, too, because it is clear to me that there will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know them and hear their broken cries. They must see Americans as strange liberators. The Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945 after a combined French and Japanese occupation and before the Communist Revolution in China. They were led by Ho Chi Minh. Even though they quoted the American Declaration of Independence in their own document of freedom, we refused to recognize them. Our government felt then that the Vietnamese people were not ready for independence, and we again fell victim to the deadly Western arrogance that has poisoned the international atmosphere for so long. For 9 years following 1945, we vigorously supported the French in their abortive effort to recolonize Vietnam. After the French were defeated, it looked as if independence and land reform would come through the Geneva Agreements. But instead, there came the United States, determined that Ho should not unify the temporarily divided nation. And the peasants watched again as we supported one of the most vicious modern dictators, our chosen man, Premier Diem. The peasants watched and cringed as Diem ruthlessly rooted out all opposition, supported their extortionist landlords, and refused even to discuss reunification with the North. The peasants watched as all this was presided over by U.S. influence, and then by the increasing numbers of United States troops who came to help quell the insurgency that Diem's methods had aroused. When Diem was overthrown, they may have been happy, but the long line of military dictatorships seemed to offer no real change, especially in terms of their need for land and peace. The only change came from America as we increased our troop commitments in support of governments which were singularly corrupt, inept, and without popular support. All the while, the people read our leaflets and received regular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. They move sadly and apathetically as we herd them off the land of their fathers into concentration camps where minimal social needs are rarely met. They know that they must move or be destroyed by our bombs, and they go primarily women and children and the aged. They watch as we poison their water, as we kill 1 million acres of their crops. They wandered into the hospitals with at least 20 casualties from American firepower for one Viet Cong inflicted injury. They wandered into the towns and see thousands of children, homeless, without clothes, running in packs on the streets like animals. They see the children selling their sisters to our soldiers, soliciting for their mothers. What do the peasants think as we ally ourselves with the landlords and as we refuse to put any action into our many words concerning land reform? Where are the roots of the independent Vietnam we claim to be building? Is it among these voiceless ones? We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. We have cooperated in crushing one of the nation's only non-communist revolutionary political forces, the United Buddhist Church. We have supported the enemies of the peasants of Saigon. We have corrupted their women and children and killed their men. What liberators! Now there is little left to build on save bitterness. And soon the only solid physical foundations remaining will be found at our military bases and in the concrete of the concentration camps we call fortified hamlets. The peasants may well wonder if we plan to build our new Vietnam on such grounds as these. Could we blame them for such thoughts? We must speak for them and raise the questions they cannot raise. These two are our brothers. Perhaps the more difficult, but no less necessary task, is to speak for those who have been designated as our enemies. What of the National Liberation Front? How can they believe in our integrity when now we speak of aggression from the North? As if there were nothing more essential to the war. How can they trust us when now we charge them with violence after the murderous reign of Diem, and charge them with violence while we pour every new weapon of death into their land? Surely we must understand their feelings, even if we do not condone their actions. How do they judge us when our officials know that their membership is less than 25% communist and yet insist on giving them the blanket name? They ask how we can speak of free elections when the Saigon press is censored and controlled by the military junta. Their questions are frighteningly relevant. Is our nation planning to build on political myth again and then show it up with the power of new violence? Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence, and it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves. Far from his view, we may indeed see the basic weakness of our own condition, and if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition. So too with Hanoi. In the north, where our bombs now pummel the land and our mines endanger the waterways, we are met by a deep but understandable mistrust. In Hanoi are the men who led the nation to independence against the Japanese and the French. It was they who led a second struggle against French domination and then were persuaded to give up the land they controlled between the 13th and 17th parallel as a temporary measure at Geneva. After 1954, they watched us conspire with Diem to prevent elections which would have surely brought Ho Chi Minh to power over the United Vietnam, and they realized they had been betrayed again. When we ask why they do not leap to negotiate, these things must be remembered. Also, it must be clear that the leaders of Hanoi considered the presence of American troops in support of the Diem regime to have been the initial military breach of the Geneva agreements concerning foreign troops. And they remind us that they did not begin to send in any large number of supplies or men until American forces had moved into the tens of thousands. Hanoi remembers how our leaders refused to tell us the truth about the earlier North Vietnamese overtures for peace. How we claim that none existed when they had clearly been made. Ho Chi Minh has watched as America has spoken of peace and built up its forces, and now he has surely heard the increasing international rumors of American plans for an invasion of the North. At this point, I should make it clear that while I have tried in these last few minutes to give a voice to the voiceless on Vietnam and to understand the arguments of those who are called the enemy, I am as deeply concerned about our own troops there as anything else. But it occurs to me that what we are submitting them to in Vietnam is not simply the brutalizing process that goes on in any war where armies face each other and seek to destroy. We are adding cynicism to the process of death, for they must know after the short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved, and the more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and the secure while we create a hell for the poor. If we continue, there will be no doubt in my mind and in the mind of the world that we have no honorable intentions in Vietnam. It will become clear that our minimal expectation is to occupy it as an American colony, and men will not refrain from thinking that our maximum hope is to goad China into a war so that we may bomb her nuclear installations. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as an American to the leaders of my own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours. Last spring, I made public the steps I consider necessary for this to happen. I should add now only that while many Americans have supported the proposals, the government has so far not recognized one of them. These are the times for real choices and not false ones. We are at the moment when our lives must be placed on the line if our nation is to survive its own folly. Every man of humane convictions must decide on the protest that best suits his conviction, but we must all protest. That is something seductively tempting about stopping there and sending us all off on what in some circles has become a popular crusade against the war in Vietnam. I say we must enter that struggle, but I wish to go on now to say something even more disturbing. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. In 1957, a sensitive American official overseas said that it seemed to him that our nation was on the wrong side of a world revolution. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say this is not just. It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say this is not just. The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of people normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense and on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual doom. This kind of positive revolution of values is our best defense against communism. War is not the answer. Communism will never be defeated by the use of atomic bombs or nuclear weapons. These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the wounds of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born. The shirtless and barefoot people of the land are rising up as never before. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. We in the West must support these revolutions. It is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. This has driven many to feel that only Marxism has a revolutionary spirit. Therefore, communism is a judgment against our failure to make democracy real and follow through on the revolutions that we initiated. We must move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world, a world that borders on our doors. If we do not act, we shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time, reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight.
Dr. Martin Luther King on Conscience and the War in Vietnam. That was the second of his five Massey lectures for 1967. The third one on youth and nonviolent action will be heard next Monday at the same time, 10:30 p.m. Today's talk was recorded in Atlanta by Janet Somerville and Del McKenzie. This series will be available for the CBC in paperback form in 1968. For a discussion of Dr. King's talk, stay tuned for the Best of Ideas, Part 2, over most of these stations after the news. Alan Maitland speaking.
Lay down my sword and shield down by the riverside.
And that was the voice of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Through the Maxey Lectures of 1967, broadcast initially over the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And, of course, that was a classic lecture, part two of a classic series of lectures delivered by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1967. And we're going to be winding down the Pan-African Journal for this week. We'd like to remind all of our listeners that the Pan-African Journal is brought to you by the Pan-African Radio Network. And, of course, the Pan-African Radio Network is a new radio network that, of course, is brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwet. We're signing off for this week, and we're encouraging all of our listeners to share this broadcast with others. This is Abayomi Ezekwet again, and have a beautiful, beautiful week.
Never like nobody that's been mean to me. I've got a heart full of stone, and I hate the misery. Then you came along into my life, destroying me more, mining up the toil and strife. But I'm a fool. Thank you.